Labor Day is almost here. I have a few more goodies for you to finish off the month of August, and then we'll move on to September. But for now, let's open up the journals and read, shall we? JAMA sometimes has good articles, and the August 15 issue has a review of celiac disease and non-celiac gluten sensitivity that's pretty good. This one is definitely geared towards the primary care provider, but it's a good review for everyone. If you need figures for your presentations or talks, these are pretty good, and I discovered something new for myself. Table 1 lists prevalence of celiac disease in various countries. The average is about 1%, but Algeria apparently has 5.6% of its population afflicted. Wow, I had no idea. Some more board pearls in the same table listing at-risk groups, which are type 1 diabetics, autoimmune thyroid disease patients, but also autoimmune liver disease at 13%. As for syndromes, Down-Turner-Williams syndrome, as well as IgA deficiency and IgA nephropathy, all are at risk for celiac disease. Also has a useful algorithm for screening for both celiac and gluten sensitivity. Bottom line is test for celiac, and if negative, it's probably FODMAPs that are largely responsible for symptoms rather than real gluten-specific autoimmunity. So what do you think is safer and more efficacious, infliximab or adalimumab? Well, both do the same thing. How different can they really be? In fact, I think most docs assume they're the same and base the choice of which one to use based on patient preference and sometimes just insurance coverage. Obviously, there was never a randomized trial comparing one to the other head-to-head. Otherwise, we'd have the answer already. And anecdotally, many IBD gurus out there say that Remicade is better for induction, but that Humira and Remicade are both about the same for maintenance. So this study in clinical gastroenterology and hepatology did a nationwide propensity score match cohort study of biologic-naive patients with ulcerative colitis in Denmark who used Remicade or Humira as first-line agents. So a risk of surgery was about the same for these patients, but Humira was associated with higher risk of hospitalization and serious infection. So it stands to reason that infliximab is probably more effective and probably safer. Last year, a similar study came out for Crohn's disease patients in the US, showing pretty much the same thing. I thought it was weird that Humira is weaker, but causes more infections somehow. But if you think about it, one is given IV and is weight-based, whereas the other one is fixed-dose subcutaneous, so it makes more sense, maybe. CGH has another paper showing that thiopurines are probably safe in pregnancy. 108 women who used thiopurines gave birth in the Netherlands, and there was no association between thiopurine use and abortions or difference in mean growth, number of infections, allergies, or chronic disease in babies at 1 year of age. Now, this was a prospective study and probably the largest so far, so that's good news for patients who are using thiopurines. Resistant ulcerative proctitis is difficult to manage. Duh, it's resistant. This next paper in CGH evaluates the use of rectal tacrolimus for induction therapy in patients with resistant ulcerative proctitis. So if you're out of ideas, this could be a good option to try. This was a double-blind, placebo-controlled study for rectal tacrolimus in 11 patients in the study group and 10 in the placebo group. Starting Mayo scores were 9 for the placebo group and 8 for the tacro group. Endoscopy Mayo scores were a mix of 2 and 3s in both groups. I think the most important question here is where did we end up with the Mayo scores endoscopically? The study was stopped early because of how well it worked. But the authors didn't really report endoscopic Mayo scores. They just said that mucosal healing was achieved in 8 patients in the tacro group and 1 in the placebo group. I think in a study like this, with this impressive of a result, it would be helpful if you had some pictures of the mucosa of each patient in the study before and after, you know, nice small panel of representative images. This would be very convincing if there's really healing going on. Anyway, this appears to be working, but this is an induction study, so not clear what to do next. There are fewer and fewer liver biopsies done in the US these days. I don't think we're saving much money by not doing them, but it's certainly safer for patients not to get them. This next paper in NEJM reviews liver biopsies and discusses alternatives to biopsy, specifically imaging and non-invasive blood tests. The scary stuff about biopsy is that even though it is the gold standard, it can be wrong. One study that this review mentions, patients had 2 biopsies on the same day, and 35% of those patients had F3 bridging fibrosis in one sample and F0 to F1 in the other. And of course, these F classifications are a bit subjective, but nonetheless, there was a big discordance between the samples. Liver biopsies also cost about $1,500 and cause pain, bleeding, and other injuries. Most liver biopsies these days done by IR and not by liver fellows. So what can we do instead? We can do indirect or direct serological markers, or even a combination, on imaging, we already kind of know what to look for. Nodular liver, enlargement of the caudate lobe, more hazy, lighter liver on the ultrasound. Elastography is way better, but better at ruling fibrosis, cirrhosis out rather than ruling it in. What about other tests? There's FIB-4 and NAFLD fibrosis scores, but none of these are perfect. So the first question you should ask is, when should you even think about non-invasive testing? This is basically falls into two categories. One, are you worried? Meaning patient looks great, labs are only slightly off, but your gut tells you that something's brewing in the liver. And second, if you're really going to use information to guide treatment, say for hepatitis C, where it's important. The reverse of that question is that who should you really, really biopsy and not rely on non-invasive testing? This list is a lot shorter. Autoimmune hepatitis, PSC, PBC, especially if it's AMA negative. Hep B, if you need to decide whether to start someone on antiviral therapy. That's pretty much it. This article has very good tables, including percentages of disease in patients with abnormal liver tests. This is useful if you're adjusting your pre- and post-test probabilities when you're seeing patients in clinic with abnormal liver tests. And as another useful table, when do you use FIB-4, APRI, and NAFLD fibrosis scores? And it actually supplies you with all the sensitivities and specificities for each. It's all right there in table one, so you don't have to Google for this anymore. NEJM reviews are mostly meh kind of reviews, but this one is a true gem. Please read it. Another gem from Elliot Tapper, who was my resident, by the way, when I was an intern. Great guy. This one is published in Liver International. It basically says that balloon tamponade, your Blakemore tubes, etc., are associated with increased mortality. But the twist here is the following. He looked at over 140,000 admissions for variceal bleeding and found that hospitals with the highest use of balloon tamponade also had the highest death rates, odds ratio of 1.17. Knowing the reason for this is very, very useful. Basically, people who died for one reason or another didn't get endoscopy within 12 hours of presentation, did not get band ligation, didn't get antibiotics pre-endoscopy, and didn't get octreotide or a combination of all these things. Meaning, key quality parameters that are drilled into our brains as interns, residents, fellows, just didn't happen. So what does this mean? As the authors put it, high rates of balloon tamponade utilization may identify areas of quality improvement. It may be also a matter of staffing, culture, and experience. So if your hospital is using too many Blakemores, maybe you're inappropriately managing your patients, that's what it means. Or you don't have the resources. But I can't believe patients are admitted to hospitals where endoscopy and banding ligation is not available within 12 hours. But I guess it does happen. IBD Journal has an article from Calgary Health Zone Hospital on clinical predictors of early colectomy in oral cervical colitis patients, meaning within a few years of diagnosis. Interesting that in this cohort, 57% of patients ended up with a colectomy within 3 years. Older males, meaning age over 35, with pancolitis and living in rural areas were risk factors. Also, if you got infliximab before hospitalization, your odds ratio of colectomy was about 5. Basically, you should tell your patients that if they are hospitalized for a UC flare that is serious, their chance of colectomy is very high. Yet another diet study trying to lower the risk of colon cancer, this time done in a multi-ethnic cohort. Here, all dietary indices, meaning DASH diet, Mediterranean diet, etc., were consistently associated with reduced risk of colon cancer across 3 cohorts. Presumably, these high-quality diets in the U.S. are lower animal fats and fats in general, and this somehow leads to less colon cancer and less deaths. So is eating carbs better for you rather than fats? Turns out it's not that simple. There's a study this month in The Lancet, a paper titled Association of Fats and Carbohydrate Intake with Cardiovascular Disease and Mortality in 18 Countries from 5 Continents was published in The Lancet this month. Unlike all the other studies that show that fats kill you, this one claims carbohydrates kill you. Most importantly, it's not focused on the US or Europe, where we all eat too much. So this large prospective cohort questionnaire-based study shows that if you get more than 60% of your calories from carbohydrates, you're at greater risk of dying. I think that access to fats and proteins is a surrogate for access to other things like better preventive health, a doctor, and other modern things that are supposed to improve mortality. Also, it turns out a low-carbohydrate diet may be better for NAFLD more than other forms of diet restriction, so maybe that's why all these people live longer. Speaking of NAFLD, 30% of the world is thought to have fatty liver disease. BMJ this month has a systematic review of all the interventions directed at NAFLD. Only randomized controlled trials are included. There were 6 trials looking at weight loss as a result of diet restriction, 10 looking at exercise, and 8 studies looked at a combination of the two. Conclusion here is that all of the trials reviewed showed reduction in steatosis. Combination interventions were most effective. So what do you tell the patients to aim for? 5 to 10% of weight loss is reasonable in combination with 30 to 60 minutes of exercise 3 to 5 days per week. And there are various studies showing that either cardiovascular or resistance exercise are probably best. Keep in mind that most of the weight loss reported in these studies came from dietary caloric restriction. Bigger question is, what do you tell patients who achieve the weight loss and exercise but still have fatty liver disease? I don't think anybody has the answer to that one. Back to gastro for this month. A meta-analysis of adding oats to a gluten-free diet for patients with celiac disease. These guys preach what is, I hope, most people practice by now. Adding oats is great and does nothing to affect symptoms or change histology or immunity in celiac patients. There are no randomized trials of this, but it's easy enough to check in your patients and relatively low risk. Anyway, oats are totally fine. I don't know how often you see international or immigrant patients in your practice, but it's important to know the prevalence of H. pylori in the country that the patient is coming from. So where do you get this data? I mean, you can just assume high prevalence, but how high? Gastro has another meta-analysis of global prevalence of H. pylori infection. So what did that show? This is interesting. Africa leads the way with 79.1% infected, Latin America with 63.4%, and Asia with 54.7%. North America is still on the board with 37.1%. Oceania is lowest at 24.4%. And the country with lowest prevalence? Switzerland. How low? About 18.9%. That's still 1 in 5. Still a lot of people. There's a table of countries listed, so if you're looking for a particular one, you can find it there. This is a bit of a minutia, but still important. Your patient with celiac disease goes on a gluten-free diet. You measure TTG. A few months later, and it's super low. Patient feels great. Can you now assume that the mucosa is healed as well? That's what the next study tried to look at. Is an undetectable TTG-IgA antibody level associated with healing in celiac disease? Is the title. Conclusions are, if you have undetectable TTG-IgA levels, you are twice as likely to have normal villous architecture compared with patients with normal but detectable levels. If you have no symptoms, you are more than twice as likely to have normal mucosal biopsy results compared with symptomatic patients. So that's kind of expected. This one is kind of interesting. In patients who had been on gluten-free diet for over 2 years, 23% with undetectable titers still had evidence of villous atrophy, as did 38% of patients with titers in the detectable negative range. What does it all mean? It means that TTG levels are not a yes or no kind of a thing. And those seeing patients with celiac disease kind of know that already. And reduction in levels is not uniformly associated with healing of the mucosa, which is not great. Has anyone heard of dung lung? This one is not so much GI related. It is more poop related story. Well, there's a case report in Morbidity Mortality Weekly Report titled Death of a Farm Worker After Exposure to Manure Gas in an Open Air Environment. Fun fact, the stuff that kills you in the stuff that makes your fart smell bad, hydrogen sulfide, the rotten egg smell, which is molecule per molecule, is as lethal as cyanide. So this farm worker was hanging out on a Wisconsin beef farm near the edge of a manure storage basin, 15 feet deep and nearly full. The man was found dead by a co-worker along with 13 dead cows. Death was initially attributed to methane exposure, was later ruled a result of exposure to hydrogen sulfide emanating from the manure storage basin. Thankfully, no gastroenterologist ever met such a fate, despite exposure to flatus on a regular basis. That's it for the month of August. Tune in September. Thanks again for listening to GI Pearls, the gastroenterology literature review. If you like what you hear, subscribe on iTunes, leave me a review, and spread the word. You can always reach me on Twitter or at gipearls.com. Thanks so much.